Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 17th annual Buck Colbert Franklin Memorial Lecture takes place at the University of Tulsa Law School and will feature a scholar who works at the intersection of national security and civil liberties. Sahar Aziz is a professor at the Texas A&M University School of Law and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Doha Center. She's a former senior policy advisor for the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And her scholarly work is focused on how national security laws and policies adversely affect racial, ethnic, and religious minorities here in the United States. She's also a specialist on the Middle East with special emphasis on the rule of law in Egypt. She's written commentaries for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Huffington Post, and the Christian Science Monitor, among others. And she'll be speaking Thursday evening at 6 at the TU Law School on civil rights in the post-9/11 era of global conflict and populism. Sahar Aziz is my guest today. Sahar Aziz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're going to be speaking on civil rights in the post-9/11 era. And in this day and age where we're seeing the rise of populism and nationalism in Europe, as well as here in the United States in our presidential politics, what effect is that having on our security and this idea of global terrorism conflict?
Well, in our generation, it's become quite evident that we are interconnected on a transnational level, both in terms of cultural exchanges, travel, internet, and information sharing among different nations and different societies, but also when it comes to threats that affect a certain country or certain region are now no longer isolated within that particular geographic area. And so with the benefits of globalization, we're also seeing other types of consequences where we have an interdependent destiny, particularly in terms of security. And I think that is something we have to think about when developing our own national security policies and our own human rights policies, is that we can no longer as a nation engage in certain interventions or certain economic or political policies abroad and assume that if things go wrong, it will not come back and directly affect us in the United States or affect Europe. And I'm hoping that that realization will reform some of the interventions, the Western interventions in the Global South and the Eastern Hemisphere in ways that will create a more rights-protective world.
Now, we were talking about the rise of populism. Do you think that's in reaction to the interventions, or do you think that was always there?
Well, with access to information and with the internet, there has been more opportunity for citizens to engage with each other, and they have more information about how their governments mismanage the state's assets or more information to prove abuse. And they also are more prone to pundits and demagogues and zealots. So again, it can be a blessing or a curse, this open access to information and this ability to reach millions, if not hundreds of millions of people through the internet. And so you are seeing both civic activism and engagement in very constructive ways across the world, but you're also seeing terrorism, which is terrorist organizations are in fact using social media in order to attempt to recruit individuals from across the world. So part of the globalization effect is a growth of populism insofar as it is citizens that are now feeling that they have to be actively engaged in how their countries are run or how their regions are run. And it can go sour or become violent, or it can be very uplifting, as we saw, for example, in the Arab Spring, where we saw tens of millions of Muslims and Arabs and Christians across the Middle East who were peacefully protesting against decades of corruption and authoritarian regimes, many of whom are directly aided militarily, economically, and politically by the United States and Western powers. So that type of populism in many ways is healthy, at least for the sake of these citizens' ability to try to control their destinies. But it also was leveraged by terrorists when the Arab Spring did not produce the democracy that the people wanted, and it created instead a brutal repression by those authoritarians, and then the terrorists exploited that malaise and that disappointment. And what we're seeing now is kind of the pendulum has swung the other way. So that's one example, at least in the Middle East. And then we're also seeing populism here. And again, it can be from the individuals who support Trump and support statements that I think are quite clearly xenophobic and racist and sexist in ways that are quite regressive. Language that we haven't heard in the public forums in decades. You know, these are former generations type of rhetoric. But at the same time, we're also seeing protests against police brutality, against abuse of government authorities in detaining families in immigration detention centers, and more kind of constructive youth activism in the United States. So the populism is not necessarily a good or a bad thing, but it is certainly a new phenomena that is affecting countries around the world.
Let's break down a couple of those areas you mentioned. From a security standpoint for the United States and Western nations, Europe, when they see xenophobic statements that have occurred in our presidential rhetoric and during this election cycle, does that have an effect on susceptibility to extremist messages?
Well, it certainly feeds into a clash of civilizations narrative that many terrorists, at least in the Middle East, are perpetuating, which is effectively that it is the West trying to destroy Islam, that the West hates Muslims and will never allow Muslims to live a dignified life of economic prosperity, their own forms of democracy, and that, in fact, the West's only interest in the Middle East is to suck the resources dry, the oil, and to bolster the dictators who keep the people repressed. And so the more that we behave in ways as a country, and the more that our public officials or those that are very high profile and have significant influence in society, such as presidential candidates, engage in behavior or rhetoric that supports that narrative, the more than those non-state militant groups or terrorists are able to leverage it to their advantage to persuade individuals who may be vulnerable to their message. So it certainly doesn't do us any favors. It also undermines our reputation abroad when we are trying to diplomatically pressure certain countries to protect their minority communities, whether they're Christian minorities in those countries or ethnic minorities. It makes it very difficult for us to have any credibility when they can point the finger back at us and say, well, here's how you treat your African-American communities. Here's how you treat your Latino communities. Here's how you treat your poor people. It just makes it where we have very little influence abroad. And in fact, this isn't anything new. When you look back to World War II and post-World War II and the Cold War, oftentimes when we would criticize whether Nazi Germany or whether we were criticizing the Soviet Union, oftentimes they would point back at the way that we were treating African Americans and arguing, well, you have Jim Crow laws. You discriminate against them as a matter of law, and normatively it's acceptable. So it sounds like your democracy really isn't democratic for everybody. And in fact, that was a big impetus behind many white liberals in government to change policies on racial justice, because it was having a major effect adversely on international relations and America's ability to kind of fight the war of ideas in the Cold War. And I think one can analogize that to the so-called global war on terror, which, although the Obama administration does not explicitly name it that, it is still, in fact, behaving
as
consistently
if
with it.
Yeah. Getting back to one of your statements of the rhetoric we're seeing today, harkening back several generations, are you talking about Japanese internment, Chinese exclusion, and apartheid in the South against African Americans? Are you talking about that level of rhetoric?
Well, we certainly have a history in this country of targeted discrimination against particular groups, whether it was obviously with slavery, that was the most atrocious and problematic part of our history, and something that I think until this day continues to impede equal rights for African Americans. So the legacy of slavery is clearly, I think, the worst violation of human rights that our country has ever engaged in, perhaps in competing with the annihilation effectively of Native Americans. So Unfortunately, our country's history has a very unstable foundation when it comes to human rights and civil rights. However, going forward, we still continued to discriminate against new groups. So whether it was the Chinese, when we didn't allow them to naturalize, and we had many laws that excluded them both from the country, but also excluded them in terms of their civil rights. And we also were quite discriminatory against Italians and Eastern Europeans and even the Irish, and partly because of their ethnicity, partly because of their religion. So with the identity of being a land of immigrants, there is also the identity of being the land that mistreats its new immigrants. And I think this is something that we need to acknowledge, and we need to break that cycle of mistreatment, because we're seeing it now with Mexican Americans and Latino Americans, with Muslim and Arab Americans. And while it's not as severe, so we are not interning people the way we did in Japan with the Japanese, while we are certainly not enslaving people, and while we are not, we do not have laws on the books that explicitly say if you are of a particular religion or of a particular race, you cannot purchase property or you cannot use this particular restaurant. However, we still have norms and practices that are producing disparities, economic disparities, social disparities, and just general feelings of mistreatment by these groups by virtue of their identities.
Let me ask you about domestic groups such as African Americans and the disparity in treatment in encounters with police and the debate over that we're currently having in our country. How does that play, say, in a country with an authoritarian regime, say in the Middle East or a Muslim majority country? Does this sort of back into the narrative that encourages extremism, in your view?
Well, I don't think it's so much that it encourages extremism. It just makes us where we do not have the credibility to criticize authoritarian regimes for mistreating their citizens if there's clear evidence that we mistreat our own citizens. So it makes it that much more difficult for us to have influence and credibility to the extent that we're seriously interested in promoting human rights, for example, in the Middle East under authoritarian regimes. I think the indirect promotion, or I should say support, of the terrorist narrative comes when we mistreat Muslims and Arabs. Because the terrorists, one of their objectives, for example, Daesh, which is the Arabic acronym for ISIS, is they have been very actively attempting to recruit Muslims that live in the West through the internet, through social media, trying to prey on any young, often male person, and telling them either come and join us here and fight with us here in Syria/Iraq, or engage in some kind of violent act in the West, just senseless violent act against a civilian or civilians. And the more that they can point to the ways in which the American government or the European government abuses and mistreats Muslims, the more that they can claim the West deserves that and they, in fact, do the same thing to us. Now, of course, any rational person knows that that is not a justification for engaging in violence, but it certainly helps in their propaganda, and unfortunately they tend to prey on very vulnerable young people who may have mental health problems, who may be going through personal crises, who are usually under the radar from their community leaders or their families, and so they're more prone to perhaps that kind of demagoguery, that kind of terroristic ideology. And we certainly should not in any way be supporting that indirectly. And we also, as a matter of principle separately, we shouldn't be mistreating our own citizens regardless of their racial or religious identities.
My guest today is Sahar Aziz, a professor at the Texas A&M University School of Law and a non-resident fellow at Brookings Doha Center. She'll be giving the 17th Annual Buck Colbert Franklin Memorial Civil Rights Lecture this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the law school on the TU campus. And she'll be speaking on civil rights in the post-9/11 era of global conflict and populism. Now, one of the things you've been writing about is, you know, the Obama administration has been trying to enlist Muslim Americans and Muslim in general to oppose terrorism. He first president to visit a mosque, I believe. But you write that says, you know, Western nations and certainly the United States are still ignoring the root cause, thinking that it is Islamic extremism. And you write that it's not so much religion as it is authoritarian governments in the region where this terrorism hatches. We've yet to see this. You've made several allusions to it in our conversation. What needs to change in our view towards these authoritarian regimes, many of which we've had relationships for decades upon decades, thinking Saudi Arabia, for example?
Well, first I wanted to clarify, it was George Bush who visited a mosque right after 9/11, and in fact Obama had not visited a mosque until very recently, and he had been criticized quite a bit by Muslim Americans for that. But of course, he was also being accused of being a secret Muslim as a as a racial slur. So that also speaks volumes about kind of the downsides of being a Muslim in America. But going back to your question, so in terms of the terrorism that's occurring in the Middle East, because I think we need to distinguish between terrorism that occurs in Europe and in the United States and that that is occurring in the Middle East. The deaths that are occurring in the Middle East are all Muslims that are dying. So it's Muslims killing Muslims, and it's a political battle. And it is a derivative of the authoritarian system that has governed that region for actually centuries, because it used to be through colonialism, and then it was through these revolutions that turned into military or civilian dictatorships. And when you live in a system like that, wherever that may be in the world, it is a zero-sum game, a very high-stakes political game, where if you lose, you die. And there is very little opportunity for negotiation or compromise. There's very little opportunity to learn the game of democracy in terms of negotiating, building political parties, winning elections, losing elections. And there's a lot of corruption involved, so there's a lot of money at stake. Those who win not only have a firm grip on power and the military forces and police forces, but they also tend to embezzle billions of dollars from the state treasury. So it creates an environment where if you want reform or change, it forces you to have to do it violently, whether it's through insurgencies, nationalist groups, terrorist groups. And that is a recipe for violence. Whether you call the groups freedom fighters or you call them terrorists or you call them military insurgents, they all are forced into using violence as a means to change the system, because those who attempt to do it nonviolently end up in prison, tortured, kidnapped, and have even their families' human rights violated. So most people are afraid to pursue the nonviolent route. And so the natural consequence of that are these terrorist groups, who then eventually morph into things that are much larger than sometimes they even started out to be. They can start out to be simply nationalist groups who want to overthrow a dictatorship, and then they expand into regional groups and terrorist groups who just want to kill as many civilians as possible and literally terrorize the population. So we need to, as the United States that is heavily engaged in the Middle East, we need to be more long-sighted in how we are going to accept or support these types of authoritarian systems, whether they're monarchs or military-led or secular civilian dictatorships. Because what we've learned is the Arab Spring was in many ways a historic, remarkable event insofar as it was nonviolent. And it was also the biggest missed opportunity that we in the West have had and those in the region have had in terms of the possibility of transitioning the region to a more indigenously democratic system. And now the terrorists have moved in and essentially reminded the people, if you want change, it must happen violently. And we know that there's no nothing good will come of that. So we need to be much more strategic in how we can ensure and support those on the ground in that region who want a more democratic system that's based on their indigenous values. So we have to be very careful not to superimpose our values and our systems, not to be imperialist. But at the same time, there are always reformists on the ground, citizens, and we need to support them and in ways that can help a peaceful, incremental transition. And at some point, we have to put our foot down to the dictators who will not leave peacefully, because they never do.
Right.
But if as long as we continue to support them politically and economically, it's almost impossible for the people to remove them except through violence.
And it seems like in the Arab Spring, we were very selective on who we wanted to see go and who we wanted to see stay. Bahrain, for example, major uprisings there. We backed the government completely. So in your view, what was the missed opportunity that we should have done during the Arab Spring that might have led to a different outcome?
We should not have so easily accepted the return of the dictators. For example, in Egypt, things were actually transitioning not smoothly in terms of the pains, the growing pains of these major transitions, but at least there was progress from going from Mubarak to then a temporary military council to then a democratically elected Mohamed Morsi, who was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. But when the coup happened in July of 2013, we sat back and essentially gave it the rubber stamp of approval and refused to call it a coup, which would have had serious legal implications in our ability to provide military aid to Egypt. And I think that was a fundamental mistake.
Was that because we didn't like the results of the election? I mean, that Morsi was affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood? And
I think that certainly had something to do with it. And I think there was quite a bit of opposition from Israel and from Saudi Arabia and from the Egyptian military and other actors in the region and in Europe that did not want Egypt to be governed by any political party that was Islamist in identity for geopolitical reasons, because they're not a partner that they're familiar with. They would rather have the reliable, predictable dictator than the democratically elected, whether they're secular, Islamist, whatever their ideology is. If they're in fact democratically elected, that means the people are going to have a larger say in the relationship between that country and other countries. And that's not something that we're adapted to. We're used to having hegemony in that region. But one of my points is the hegemony has only, or this our foreign policy has led to less security for the region, which produces less security for us and for Europe. So this kind of post-colonial model that is still based on our political hegemony is not working. And I think what we're seeing now in Europe with the terrorist attacks there and now with the huge refugee crisis, which is a separate issue, it is proof that we are all interconnected. We can no longer engage in policies that make people, for example, in the Middle East less safe while continuing to live our lives as normal.
Earlier you referred to the fact that in these Middle Eastern countries it's a zero-sum game and there's very little chance to learn the game of democracy. I think that's been one of the post-Arab Spring criticisms within certain segments of U.S. foreign policy views. Is that a little paternalistic, or what is your assessment of that we sort of believe that it's going to take a lot longer for these countries to learn the game of democracy?
Well, if we were not intervening in their affairs through our military and economic political support of the dictatorships, then I think the paternalistic argument would be more credible. The problem with it is that we are intervening. And we are intervening in ways that is impeding the ability of indigenous reformers to transition the country from within. So I certainly do not support us parachuting in and imposing a Western American-style democratic system, because it's a completely different context. But what I'm troubled by is that we believe by supporting the governments, we're not intervening in internal affairs, because what we do is we put a very, very heavy thumb in favor of those who don't want reform and who don't want self-autonomy by the people and more empowerment by the people in how they're governed. And when we do that, that indirectly impedes the citizens' ability to build their nation and transition it into the 21st century, where they can have a much more democratic, democratic meaning that the people have more say in how their government behaves and uses resources and allocates resources. So as long as we continue to support these dictators, we are engaging in an intervention. If we're willing to stop supporting them, then I think at least the people will then have to work it out among themselves, and it won't always be a smooth transition. But I think over time that it will eventually come about. But as long as we are intervening, then we have to, at the very least, acknowledge that it's making us less safe. It's making them less safe, and it's making us less safe.
Is a hands-off approach the better approach? I think when I think back to the Arab Spring and places where at one point we were hands-off and we intervene in Libya, Syria, what is the best approach?
Well, I don't think that any country can be hands-off in general because we are now so interlinked. For example, I don't think that it would be moral to allow genocide to occur in any country and say, well, that's none of our business, for example. But the engagement can be through the international community, using international mechanisms, international legal mechanisms, as opposed to unilateral interventions or interventions that produce or predictably produce more violence rather than less violence. I think the other assumption that your question makes, which I'm not as convinced by, is that we were not engaged with the Libyan issue and with the Syrian issue. We may not have been overtly engaged. We may not have sent in, at least with Syria, our military, but we have always been engaged through intelligence services, through proxies, through allies. So we are very heavily engaged in the Middle East from the United States perspective. And in Libya, we certainly engaged in the airstrikes. But part of the problem is that in a place like Libya, for example, the damage that has been done has been so severe by Gaddafi that now you have this state that has no state, and you have a very small population, actually only about 4 million, who are now free from this dictator and trying to figure out how they're going to rule each other. And it's a tribal society, so you have divisions within the society. And you also have proxies that are supporting different sides. So the Egyptians are playing one side, the Italians are playing another. We're supporting one side. So we are engaged and we are intervening. And I'm not proposing that the answers are simple. I am just essentially saying that what we've been doing in the past is not working, and we need to do some major rethinking of how we're going to engage the Middle East. And we need to do it accepting or acknowledging that if we don't figure out a way to make them more secure and more prosperous, it will boomerang back to us because of this kind of new globalized, interconnected world that we live in.
You can hear more at the 17th Annual Buck Colbert Franklin Memorial Civil Rights Lecture at the TU Law School this Thursday. Sahar Aziz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sahar Aziz is a professor of law at the Texas A&M University School of Law and a non-resident fellow at Brookings Doha Center. She'll be giving the 17th Annual Buck Colbert Franklin Memorial Civil Rights Lecture at the TU Law School Thursday at 6 p.m., speaking on civil rights in the post-9/11 era of global conflict and populism. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.